Craig was 9 years old when his father died of a heart attack. He was actually sort of relieved that the Bank of America's answer to General Patton was gone. His mother was an alcoholic whose drinking had been controlled only by her fear of the man she had married. Once Roger Toomey was safely in the ground, where he could no longer search out her bottles and break them or slap her and tell her to get a hold of herself, for God's sakes, Catherine Toomey began her life's work in earnest. She alternately smothered her son with affection and froze him with rejection, depending on how much gin was currently perking through her bloodstream. Her behavior was often odd and sometimes bizarre. On the day Craig turned 10, she placed a wooden kitchen match between two of his toes, lit it, and sang, "Happy birthday to you," while it burned slowly down toward his flesh. She told him that if he tried to shake it out or kick it loose, she would take him to the orphan's home at once. The threat of the orphan's home was a frequent one when Catherine Toomey was loaded.
"I ought to anyway," she told him as she lit the match, which stuck up between her weeping son's toes like a skinny birthday candle. "You're just like your father. He didn't know how to have fun, and neither do you. You're a bore, Craigie Waggy."
She finished the song and blew out the match before the skin of Craig's second and third right toes was more than singed. But Craig never forgot the yellow flame, the curling, blackening stick of wood, and the growing heat as his mother warbled,
"Happy birthday, dear Craigie Waggy, happy birthday to you,"
in her droning, off-key drunk's voice. Pressure. Pressure in the trenches. Craig Toomey continued to get all A's, and he continued to spend a lot of time in his room. The place which had been his Coventry had become his refuge. Mostly he studied there, but sometimes when things were going badly, when he felt pressed to the wall, he would take one piece of notepaper after another and tear them into narrow strips. He would let them flutter around his feet in a growing drift while his eyes stared out blankly into space. But these blank periods were not frequent. Not then. He graduated valedictorian from high school. His mother didn't come. She was drunk. He graduated 9th in his class from the UCLA Graduate School of Management. His mother didn't come. She was dead. In the dark trench which existed in the center of his own heart, Craig was quite sure that the Langoliers had finally come for her. Craig went to work for the Desert Sun Banking Corporation of California as part of the executive training program. He did very well, which was not surprising. Craig Toomey had been built, after all, to get all A's, built to thrive under pressures which exist in the deep fathoms, and sometimes following some small reverse at work. And in those days, only 5 short years ago, all the reverses had been small ones, he would go back to his apartment in Westwood, less than half a mile from the condo Brian Engel would occupy following his divorce, and tear small strips of paper for hours at a time. The paper-tearing episodes were gradually becoming more frequent. During those 5 years, Craig ran the corporate fast track like a greyhound chasing a mechanical rabbit. Water cooler gossip speculated that he might well become the youngest vice president in Desert Sun's glorious 40-year history. But some fish are built to rise just so far and no farther. They explode if they transgress their built-in limits. 8 months ago, Craig Toomey had been put in sole charge of his first big project, the corporate equivalent of the master's thesis. This project was created by the bonds department. Bonds, foreign bonds and junk bonds, they were frequently the same, were Craig's specialty. This project proposed buying a limited number of questionable South American bonds, sometimes called bad debt bonds, on a carefully set schedule. The theory behind these buys was sound enough, given the limited insurance on them that was available and the much larger tax breaks available on turnovers resulting in a profit. Uncle Sam was practically falling all over himself to keep the complex structure of South American indebtedness from collapsing like a house of cards. It just had to be done carefully. Craig Toomey had presented a daring plan which raised a good many eyebrows. It centered upon a large buy of various Argentinian bonds, generally considered to be the worst of a bad lot. Craig had argued forcefully and persuasively for his plan, producing facts, figures, and projections to prove his contention that Argentinian bonds were a good deal more solid than they looked. In one bold stroke, he argued, Desert Sun could become the most important and richest buyer of foreign bonds in the American West. The money they made, he said, would be a lot less important than the long-run credibility they would establish. After a good deal of discussion, some of it hot, Craig's take on the project got a green light. Tom Holby, a senior vice president, had drawn Craig aside after the meeting to offer congratulations and a word of warning.
If this comes off the way you expect at the end of the fiscal year, you're going to be everybody's fair-haired boy. If it doesn't, you're going to find yourself in a very windy place, Craig. I'd suggest that the next few months might be a good time to build a storm shelter.
I won't need a storm shelter, Mr. Holby, Craig said confidently. After this, what I'll need is a hang glider. This is going to be the bond buy of the century, like finding diamonds at a barn sale. Just wait and see.
He had gone home early that night, and as soon as his apartment door was closed and triple-locked behind him, the confident smile had slipped from his face. What replaced it was that unsettling look of blankness. He had bought the news magazines on the way home. He took them into the kitchen, squared them up neatly in front of him on the table, and began to rip them into long, narrow strips. He went on doing this for over 6 hours. He ripped until Newsweek, Time, and U.S. News and World Report lay in shreds on the floor all around him. His Gucci loafers were buried. He looked like the lone survivor of an explosion in a ticker tape factory. The bonds he had proposed buying, the Argentinian bonds in particular, were a much higher risk than he had let on. He had pushed his proposal through by exaggerating some facts, suppressing others, and even making some up out of whole cloth. Quite a few of these latter, actually. Then he had gone home, ripped strips of paper for hours, and wondered why he had done it. He did not know about the fish that exist in trenches, living their lives and dying their deaths without ever seeing the sun. He did not know that there are both fish and men whose bête noire is not pressure, but the lack of it. He only knew that he had been under an unbreakable compulsion to buy those bonds, to paste a target on his own forehead. Now he was due to meet with bond representatives of 5 large banking corporations at the Prudential Center in Boston. There would be much comparing of notes, much speculation about the future of the world bond market, much discussion about the buys of the last 16 months and the results of those buys. And before the first day of the 3-day conference was over, they would all know what Craig Toomey had known for the last 90 days. The bonds he had purchased were now worth less than 6 cents on the dollar. And not long after that, the top brass at Desert Sun would discover the rest of the truth, that he had bought more than 3 times as much as he had been empowered to buy. He had also invested every penny of his personal savings. Not that they would care about that. Who knows how the fish captured in one of those deep trenches and brought swiftly toward the surface, toward the light of a sun it is never suspected may feel. Is it not at least possible that its final moments are filled with ecstasy rather than horror? That it senses the crushing reality of all that pressure only as it finally falls away? That it thinks, as far as fish may be supposed to think, that is, in a kind of joyous frenzy? I am free of that weight at last, in the seconds before it explodes? Probably not. Fish from those dark depths may not feel at all, at least not in any way we could recognize. And they certainly do not think. But people do. Instead of feeling shame, Craig Toomey had been dominated by vast relief and a kind of hectic, horrified happiness as he boarded American Pride's Flight 29 to Boston. He was going to explode, and he found he didn't give a damn. In fact, he found himself looking forward to it. He could feel the pressure peeling away from all the surfaces of his skin as he rose toward the surface. For the first time in weeks, there had been no paper ripping. He had fallen asleep before Flight 29 even left the gate, and he had slept like a baby until that blind little brat had begun to caterwaul. And now they told him everything had changed. And that simply could not be allowed. It must not be allowed. He had been firmly caught in the net, had felt the dizzying rise in the stretch of his skin as it tried to compensate. They could not now change their minds and drop him back into the deeps. Bangor? Bangor, Maine? Oh, no. No, indeed. Craig Toomey was vaguely aware that most of the people on Flight 29 had disappeared, but he didn't care. They weren't the important thing.
They weren't part of what his father had always liked to call the big picture. The meeting at the Prue was part of the big picture. This crazy idea of diverting to Bangor, Maine. Whose scheme exactly had that been? It had been the pilot's idea, of course. Engel's idea. The so-called captain. Engel. Now, Engel might very well be part of the big picture. He might, in fact, be an agent of the enemy. Craig had suspected this in his heart from the moment when Engel had begun to speak over the intercom. But in this case, he hadn't needed to depend on his heart, had he? No, indeed. He had been listening to the conversation between the skinny kid and the man in the fire sale sport coat. The man's taste in clothes was terrible. But what he had to say made perfect sense to Craig Toomey. At least, up to a point. In that case, the pilot would be one of us, the kid had said. Yes and no, the guy in the fire sale sport coat had said. In my scenario, the pilot is the pilot. The pilot who just happened to be on board, supposedly dead heading to Boston. The pilot who just happened to be sitting less than 30 feet from the cockpit door. Engel, in other words. And the other fellow, the one who had twisted Craig's nose, was clearly in on it with him, serving as kind of a sky marshal to protect Engel from anyone who happened to catch on. He hadn't eavesdropped on the conversation between the kid and the man in the fire sale sport coat much longer, because around that time, the man in the fire sale sport coat stopped making sense and began babbling a lot of crazy shit about Denver and Des Moines and Omaha being gone. The idea that three large American cities could simply disappear was absolutely out to lunch. But that didn't mean everything the old guy had to say was out to lunch. It was an experiment, of course. That idea wasn't silly, not a bit. But the old guy's idea that all of them were test subjects was just more crackpot stuff. Me, Craig thought. It's me. I'm the test subject. All his life, Craig had felt himself a test subject in an experiment just like this one. This is the question, gentlemen, of ratio. Pressure to success. The right ratio produces some X factor. What X factor? That is what our test subject, Mr. Craig Toomey, will show us. But then Craig Toomey had done something they hadn't expected, something none of their cats and rats and guinea pigs had ever dared to do. He had told them he was pulling out. But you can't do that. You'll explode. Will I? Fine. And now it all had become clear to him. So clear. These other people were either innocent bystanders or extras who had been hired to give this stupid little drama some badly needed verisimilitude. The whole thing had been rigged with one object in mind. To keep Craig Toomey away from Boston. To keep Craig Toomey from opting out of the experiment. But I'll show them, Craig thought. He pulled another sheet from the in-flight magazine and looked at it. It showed a happy man. A man who had obviously never heard of the Langoliers. Who obviously did not know they were lurking everywhere. Behind every bush and tree and every shadow just over the horizon. The happy man was driving down a country road behind the wheel of his Avis rental car. The ad said that when you showed your American Pride frequent flyer card at the Avis desk, they'd just about give you that rental car, and maybe a game show hostess to drive it as well. He began to tear a strip of paper from the side of the glossy ad. The long, slow ripping sound was at the same time excruciating and exquisitely calming. I'll show them. That when I say I'm getting out, I mean what I say. He dropped the strip onto the floor and began on the next one. It was important to rip slowly. It was important that each strip should be as narrow as possible, but you couldn't make them too narrow, or they got away from you and petered out before you got to the bottom of the page. Getting each one just right demanded sharp eyes and fearless hands. And I've got 'em. You better believe it. You just better believe it. I might have to kill the pilot. His hand stopped halfway down the page. He looked out the window and saw his own long, pallid face superimposed over the darkness. I might have to kill the Englishman, too. Craig Toomey had never killed anyone in his life. Could he do it? With growing relief, he decided that he could. Not while they were still in the air, of course. The Englishman was very fast, very strong. and up here there were no weapons that were sure enough. But once they landed, yes, if I have to, yes. After all, the conference at the Pru was scheduled to last for 3 days. It seemed now that his late arrival was unavoidable, but at least he would be able to explain. He had been drugged and taken hostage by a government agency. It would stun them. He could see their startled faces as he stood before them. The 300 bankers from all over the country assembled to discuss bonds and indebtedness. Bankers who would instead hear the dirty truth about what the government was up to. My friends, I was abducted by... and was able to escape only when I... If I have to, I can kill them both. In fact, I can kill them all. Craig Toomey's hands began to move again. He tore off the rest of the strip, dropped it on the floor, and began on the next one. There were a lot of pages in the magazine. There were a lot of strips to each page, and that meant a lot of work lay ahead before the plane landed. But he wasn't worried. Craig Toomey was a can-do type of guy. Laurel Stevenson didn't go back to sleep, but she did slide into a light doze. Her thoughts, which became something close to dreams in this mentally untethered state, turned to why she had really been going to Boston. "I'm supposed to be starting my first real vacation in 10 years," she had said, but that was a lie. It contained a small grain of truth, but she doubted if she had been very believable when she told it. She had not been raised to tell lies, and her technique was not very good. Not that any of the people left on Flight 29 would have cared much either way, she supposed. Not in this situation. The fact that you were going to Boston to meet, and almost certainly sleep with, a man you had never met paled next to the fact that you were heading east in an airplane from which most of the passengers and all the crew had disappeared. "Dear Laurel, I am so much looking forward to meeting you. You won't even have to double-check my photo when you step out of the jetway. I'll have so many butterflies in my stomach that all you need to do is look for the guy who's floating somewhere near the ceiling." His name was Darren Crosby. She wouldn't need to look at his photograph, that much was true. She had memorized his face just as she had memorized most of his letters. The question was why. And to that question she had no answer, not even a clue. It was just another proof of J.R.R. Tolkien's observation. You must be careful each time you step out of your door, because your front walk is really a road, and the road leads ever onward. And if you aren't careful, you're apt to find yourself, well, simply swept away, a stranger in a strange land with no clue as to how you got there. Laurel had told everyone where she was going, but she had told no one why she was going or what she was doing. She was a graduate of the University of California with a master's degree in library science. Although she was no model, she was cleanly built and pleasant enough to look at. She had a small circle of good friends, and they would have been flabbergasted by what she was up to. Heading off to Boston, planning to stay with a man she knew only through correspondence, a man she had met through the extensive personals column of a magazine called Friends and Lovers. She was, in fact, flabbergasted herself. Darren Crosby was 6'1", weighed 180 pounds, and had dark blue eyes. He preferred scotch, although not to excess. He had a cat named Stanley. He was a dedicated heterosexual. He was a perfect gentleman, or so he claimed, and he thought Laurel was the most beautiful name he had ever heard. The pictures he had sent showed a man with a pleasant, open, intelligent face. She guessed he was the sort of man who would look sinister if he didn't shave twice a day. And that was really all she knew. Laurel had corresponded with half a dozen men over half a dozen years. It was a hobby, she supposed. But she had never expected to take the next step. This step. She supposed that Darren's wry and self-deprecating sense of humor was part of the attraction, but she was dismally aware that her real reasons were not in him at all, but in herself. And wasn't the real attraction her own inability to understand this strong desire to step out of character? To just fly off into the unknown, hoping for the right kind of lightning to strike? "What are you doing?" she asked herself again. The plane ran through some light turbulence and back into smooth air again. Laurel stirred out of her doze and looked around. She saw the young teenage girl had taken the seat across from her. She was looking out the window. "What do you see?" Laurel asked. "Anything?"
"Well, the sun's up," the girl said, "but that's all."
"What about the ground?" Laurel didn't want to get up and look for herself. Dinah's head was still resting on her, and Laurel didn't want to wake her.
"Can't see it. It's all clouds down there."
She looked around. Her eyes had cleared, and a little color, not much but a little, had come back into her face.
"My name's Bethany Sims. What's yours?"
"Laurel Stevenson."
"Do you think we'll be all right?"
"I think so," Laurel said, and then added reluctantly, "I hope so."
"I'm scared about what might be under those clouds," Bethany said. "But I was scared anyway, about Boston. My mother all at once decided how it would be a great idea if I spent a couple of weeks with my Aunt Shauna, even though school starts again in 10 days. I think the idea was for me to get off the plane just like Mary's little lamb, and then Aunt Shauna pulls the string on me."
"What string?"
"Do not pass go. Do not collect $200. Go directly to the nearest rehab and start drying out," Bethany said.
She raked her hands through her short, dark hair.
"Things were already so weird that this seems just like more of the same."
She looked Laurel over carefully and then added with perfect seriousness,
"This is really happening, isn't it? I mean, I've already pinched myself several times. Nothing's changed."
"It's real."
"It doesn't seem real," Bethany said. "It seems like one of those stupid disaster movies, Airport 1990, something like that. I keep looking around for a couple of old actors like Wilford Brimley and Olivia de Havilland. They're supposed to meet during the shitstorm and fall in love, you know?"
"I don't think they're on the plane," Laurel said gravely. They glanced into each other's eyes, and for a moment they almost laughed together. It could have made them friends if it had happened, but it didn't. Not quite.
"What about you, Laurel? Do you have a disaster movie problem?"
"I'm afraid not," Laurel replied. And then she did begin to laugh, because the thought which shot across her mind in red neon was, "Oh, you liar." Bethany put a hand over her mouth and giggled.
"Jesus," she said after a minute. "I mean, this is the ultimate hairball, you know?"
Laurel nodded. "I know." She paused and then asked, "Do you need a rehab, Bethany?"
"I don't know."
She turned to look out the window again. Her smile was gone, and her voice was morose.
"I guess I might. I used to think it was just party time, but now I don't know. I guess it's out of control. But getting shipped off this way, I feel like a pig in a slaughterhouse chute."
"I'm sorry," Laurel said. But she was also sorry for herself. The blind girl had already adopted her. She did not need a second adoptee. Now that she was fully awake again, she found herself scared. Badly scared. She did not want to be behind this kid's dumpster if she was going to offload a big pile of disaster movie angst. The thought made her grin again. She simply couldn't help it. It was the ultimate hairball. It really was.
"I'm sorry, too," Bethany said. "But I guess it's the wrong time to worry about it, huh?"
"I guess maybe it is," Laurel said.
"The pilot never disappeared in any of those airport movies, did he?"
"Not that I remember."
"It's almost 6 o'clock, 2.5 hours to go."
"Yes."
"If only the world's still there," Bethany said. "That'll be enough for a start."
She looked closely at Laurel again.
"I don't suppose you've got any grass, do you?"
"I'm afraid not." Bethany shrugged and offered Laurel a tired smile, which was oddly winning.
"Well," she said, "you're one ahead of me. I'm just afraid."
Sometime later, Brian Engel rechecked his heading, his airspeed, his navigational figures, and his charts. Last of all, he checked his wristwatch. It was 8:02. "Well," he said to Nick without looking around,
"I think it's about that time. Shit or git."
He reached forward and flicked on the fasten seatbelt sign. The bell made its low, pleasant chime. Then he flicked the intercom toggle and picked up the mic. "Hello, ladies and gentlemen. This is Captain Engel again. We're currently over the Atlantic Ocean, roughly 30 miles east of the main coast, and I'll be commencing our initial descent into the Bangor area very soon. Under ordinary circumstances, I wouldn't turn on the seatbelt sign so early, but these circumstances aren't ordinary, and my mother always said prudence is the better part of valor. In that spirit,
I want you to make sure your lap belts are snug and secure. Conditions below us don't look especially threatening, but since I have no radio communication, the weather is going to be something of a surprise package for all of us. I kept hoping the clouds would break, and I did see a few small holes over Vermont, but I'm afraid they've closed up again. I can tell you from my experience as a pilot that the clouds you see below us don't suggest very bad weather to me. I think the weather in Bangor may be overcast with some light rain. I'm beginning our descent now. Please be calm. My board is green across, and all procedures here on the flight deck remain routine. Brian had not bothered programming the autopilot for descent. He now began the process himself. He brought the plane around in a long, slow turn, and the seat beneath him canted slightly forward as the 767 began its slow slide down toward the clouds at 4,000 feet. "Very comforting, that," Nick said. "You should have been a politician, matey." "I doubt if they're feeling very comfortable right now," Brian said. "I know I'm not." He was, in fact, more frightened than he had ever been while at the controls of an airplane. The pressure leak on Flight 7 from Tokyo seemed like a minor glitch in comparison to this situation. His heart was beating slowly and heavily in his chest like a funeral drum. He swallowed and heard a click in his throat. Flight 29 passed through 30,000 feet, still descending. The white, featureless clouds were closer now. They stretched from horizon to horizon like some strange ballroom floor.
"I'm scared shitless, mate," Nick Hopewell said in a strange, hoarse voice.
"I saw men die in the Falklands. Took a bullet in the leg there myself. Got the Teflon knee to prove it. And I came within an ace of getting blown up by a truck bomb in Beirut in 82, that was. But I've never been as scared as I am right now. Part of me would like to grab you and make you take us right back up. Just as far up as this bird will go." "It wouldn't do any good," Brian replied. His own voice was no longer steady. He could hear his heartbeat in it, making it jig-jag up and down in minute variations. "Remember what I said before. We can't stay up here forever."
"I know it, but I'm afraid of what's under those clouds, or not under them."
"Well, we'll all find out together." "No help for it, is there, mate?" "Not a bit." The 767 passed through 25,000 feet, still descending. All the passengers were in the main cabin. Even the bald man, who had stuck stubbornly to his seat in business class for most of the flight, had joined them. And they were all awake, except for the bearded man at the very back of the plane. They could hear him snoring blithely away, and Albert Costner felt one moment of bitter jealousy, a wish that he could wake up after they were safely on the ground, as the bearded man would most likely do, and say what the bearded man was most likely going to say.
"Where the hell are we?"
The only other sound was the soft rip, rip, rip of Craig Toomey's dismembering the in-flight magazine. He sat with his shoes in a deep pile of paper strips.
"Would you mind stopping that?" Don Gaffney asked.
His voice was tight and strained.
"It's driving me up the wall, buddy."
Craig turned his head, regarded Don Gaffney with a pair of wide, smooth, empty eyes, turned his head back, held up the page he was currently working on, which happened to be the eastern half of the American Pride route map. Rip! Gaffney opened his mouth to say something, then closed it tight. Laurel had her arm around Dinah's shoulders. Dinah was holding Laurel's free hand in both of hers. Albert sat with Robert Jenkins, just ahead of Gaffney. Ahead of him was the girl with the short dark hair. She was looking out the window, her body held so stiffly upright it might have been wired together. And ahead of her sat Baldy from business class.
"Well, at least we'll be able to get some chow," he said loudly.
No one answered. The main cabin seemed encased in a stiff shell of tension. Albert Costner felt each individual hair on his body standing at attention. He searched for the comforting cloak of Ace Costner, that Duke of the Desert, that Baron of the Buntline, and could not find him. Ace had gone on vacation. The clouds were much closer now. They had lost their flat look. Laurel could now see fluffy curves and mild crenellations filled with early morning shadows. She wondered if Darren Crosby was still down there, patiently waiting for her at a Logan Airport arrivals gate somewhere along the American Pride concourse. She was not terribly surprised to find she didn't care much, one way or another. Her gaze was drawn back to the clouds, and she forgot all about Darren Crosby. who liked scotch, although not to excess, and claimed to be a perfect gentleman.